we're driving through Connecticut in America. My producer just spoke to Bill Griffith. We're on his way to his house, and I am unbelievably excited. He is one of the reasons back in the 1980s I became a cartoonist myself. It's like meeting Elvis for me. He is such a god of cartooning. I'm a little overexcited.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care.
Before I go down his garden path in the woods, I must tell you I've got a lengthy relationship with Bill Griffith. I was about 14 when I bought my first underground comics, and among them was Bill Zippy the Pinhead, a countercultural epic featuring an engaging microcephalic, hence Pinhead.
Fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Sunlight's up the
day.
Mr. Yes. Bill Griffith. Hello, sir. Phil Jivitus. And before I go inside his studio, I should mention that I love comic strips so much I became a cartoonist myself, scribbling my way into the cut-and-paste world of music fanzines. I've often wondered whether it was a mistake to leave my pens behind, and now I've the chance to meet some of those creators who inspired me, running the risk of being seduced back to my drawing board all over again. And while I'm at it, perhaps I can convince any doubting Thomases who don't think the four-panel comic strip is that worthy that it's maybe the most underrated artistic medium there is.
We're in Bill Griffith's inner sanctum here. I've walked into the room and straight away there's just a bookcase which is full of a beautifully random selection of stuff here. The top few shelves have got Zippy material. There's more American comics. I can see an Ernie Bushmiller collection there. Mad magazine, Dick Tracy. It's wonderfully cluttered. Do you need...
And this is the Neaton version.
You're tidied up here.
I knew people were coming over.
So this here, obviously, there's drawers and drawers, I'd imagine, full of artwork.
Yeah, just daily strips.
I mean, there's got to be half a ton of strip artwork in that thing there.
Over there, too, and over there, too. This is my pension. You know, I sell this stuff occasionally.
Yeah. What does your stuff sort of fetch now?
The daily strips sell for between $350 and $500 each. Yeah. And then the older work goes up in the thousands.
Is this like the kind of alternative comic stuff you
did? Yeah, the stuff I did from the late 60s to the late 70s is the most valuable.
I mean, Bill, this is stuff here, not only your own work as well, but stuff that you read as a child. What were the first comic strips you read as a boy?
Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy was the first comic I read. When I was a kid living in Brooklyn in the late 40s, when I was 5 years old, we got the Daily News, which had great Sunday comics. And my parents encouraged me to read it because they thought it would introduce me to reading. There are like three words in the entire strip.
What is it about Nancy? There's something about the line is quite attractive because they used to run Nancy in the Daily Mirror when I was a boy in England in the 60s.
Well, Nancy is the one comic strip that it's more difficult not to read than to read. It's so simple.
Inspired by Nancy and after studying fine art, Bill Griffith went on to become part of an alternative comics movement that railed against the established trend of superheroes and talking animals. Together with artists like Robert Crumb and Gilbert Shelton, they produced offbeat, sometimes disturbing comics that quickly found a cult following. It was later with Zippy the Pinhead that he catapulted to national attention in the States. A daily strip where Griffey critiques American politics and culture, accompanied by the bizarre responses of his sidekick Zippy. It's an alluring mix of harsh reality and lyrical surrealism.
Zippy and Griffey are the two basic voices inside my head when I'm doing the strip. Zippy is the open, receptive, childlike part of me that doesn't edit or criticize, accepts everything, swims in the culture happily. And Griffey is his diametric opposite. Griffey is opinionated, he's cranky, he looks at everything as a threat, he analyzes everything, and of course they bounce off each other perfectly because they're opposites. They're like a comedy duo, like Abbott and Costello or something.
Here's the odd thing. I mean, it's a strip that is broadly critical of the America that spawned it.
I have a love-hate relationship with America, and I think most Americans do, or most, pseudo-intellectual Americans anyway. And if you have a love-hate relationship with equal amounts of both, when you satirize the thing that you have the love-hate relationship with, you're doing it from an affectionate point of view. Satire without affection is bile. It's bitter.
Yeah.
The best satire comes from the recognition that within the satirist and within all of us are diametrically opposite forces that are equally important. To be all one thing is a false way of living.
Another strip I've read devoutly since my teens is the brilliantly satirical Doonesbury. Published daily in The Guardian and, get this, more than 1,500 other newspapers around the world. After some lengthy transatlantic negotiations, we were lucky enough to arrange a rare meeting with its creator, Gary Trudeau, tucked away in his studio apartment near Central Park in New York. As soon as I went through his front door, I could tell he was a political animal.
Move along the corridor here. One of the fabulous things, you've got a large photo reproduction of the cover of the New York Times from August the 9th, 1974. Nixon resigns.
A very tragic day for people in my profession. We lost a lot that day. By the way, we also feel the same way about George W. Bush. You know, the sad reality of satire is the worse things are for the country, the better it is for people in my profession. Hope is the enemy.
This was a man inspired by the greatest political scandal of the 20th century.
Watergate had all of us in its thrall. It was a tremendous time for cartoonists. The newsweeklies were filled with editorial cartoons. It was a kind of a golden period for political cartooning. And there was something new every day. And for my medium, which was syndicated daily strips, that was problematic because at the time the convention was you work 6 weeks in advance. And there was a new high-level official resigning every week, and that became quite problematic, and so my deadline kept shrinking and shrinking, and it was 4 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 weeks. And finally, by the end of that period, I had a one-week lead, which is what I have to this day.
And Doonesbury is a hugely ambitious work, lambasting the hypocrisies and failings of the powerful through a vast range of characters, from a cynical soldier to a gay talk show host to an amoral drug fiend former American ambassador to China. Well, it is supposed to be a comic. I told Trudeau that it was his strip rather than the editorial columns that really taught me all about American politics.
I hate to have that kind of responsibility, but cartoonists are basically opportunists. We paddle offshore hoping to ride the next great surge of conventional wisdom in, and if we create a big enough splash, sometimes we're given credit for creating the wave, but I don't think that's probably the way it works most of the time. They may crystallize something that's in the air, but they don't put it in the air in the first place. Mm. They simply react to it. So I don't think that the strip all by itself would have made a whole lot of sense to you if you weren't already somewhat familiar with the things that I was writing about.
The Guardian newspaper wanted to provide a British counterpoint to Doonesbury and took on former art teacher Steve Bell shortly before the Falklands War. His strip, If, holds up an inky mirror to the daily soap opera of the Westminster Village. On a nice sunny day, I went down to Brighton to see the great man at work.
This is very, very telling. We're outside Steve Bell's house. I don't know if this has been stage managed, but there's a recycling bay for newspapers with a Morning Star and an Independent in it, which is quite delightful. And then next to it, there's four empty bottles of beer in the glass recycling thing. So it's actually, for those of you that had the image of the political cartoonist as kind of embittered drunk, hunched over his drawing board, the images outside Steve Bell's front door certainly conform to that.
Well, when he opened the door, he was neither drunk nor bitter. He took me through his spacious house to his cramped studio, an entirely different working environment to the clean, almost fastidiously tidy workspace of Gary Trudeau.
Around the corner, I actually had a fiver that the garage was going to be your workspace.
It's like a sort of greenhousey bit added onto the back of the garage.
It is indeed.
Lots of windows, very
lots
bright.
Of natural light. Is this where you do the lion's share of the... This is it, here?
You can see it's a mess. It's just a heap of old used tissues and pictures of people hanging around, and it's been like this for years.
There's got to be here around about 100 ink bottles here.
Most of them.
Coloured inks, and then right in front of us here is the watercolour tablets, and everywhere there's photographs of politicians everywhere. Barack Obama, there's Hillary Clinton. There's a marvellously blurred image of David Davis, where he actually looks like Henry Cooper.
I've been trying to do him for ages, but that's a good picture because it shows something about the way his head's structured, which is sort of weird.
So I always remember when you used to go to a conference, Conservative Party conference, now Labour Party conference, you still go.
Yes, yes.
Is it very important for you to physically see these people?
Yeah, it helps because when you see them in the round, you sort of pick up stuff you miss in looking at photos all day. And they change all the time. Politicians don't remain the same. There's strange little quirks that come through, like Tony Blair. His other eyeball goes mad too. You can pick up on that. I mean, I picked up on the eyeball thing by going to a conference. That was the first time I realised that he had this mad stare. And it was looking at him closely with my little sketchbook.
Have you got one of those books we can have a look at?
Let's have
a look at one of Steve Bell's conference sketchbooks. So,
what is it? Yeah, 94 conference.
There we go.
This is the one in question.
A bit of history here.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'll find it for you because I know it's a little pencil sketch. So, yeah, that's it. That's
the one. So before he was even in.
Yeah, this is 94. This is his first conference as leader. He was on a monitor somewhere, and suddenly I saw this flash. I noted it down, and the flash was his left eye, mad, and his right eye, twinkling. So I thought, mad, twinkling, mad.
So this is the very first sketch that Steve Bell did of the crazy Blair eyes, the defining... But do you need that one visual thing to kind of anchor into them?
Well, it helps, but you don't always get that.
It was Bell who trashed John Major's safely cultivated public image with his cartoons of the former Prime Minister wearing grey underpants over his trousers, proving his images can be more lasting than the people he lampoons.
Doing comics, you're taking these characters and you're turning them into your playthings. My characters are the politicians, so I could take Margaret Thatcher and I could make her do things. I remember one storyline, it went on for weeks, it was about live experimentation on animals, and so it had her as a monkey in a box, but she was being experimented on by being forced to live on benefits. In a strip, you can do that. You can take a story, you can just take it for a walk, and if it works, it's wonderful.
Here's the thing. This little four-frame strip, just stuck at the bottom of the back page of newspapers, has almost unlimited potential. Canadian artist Lynn Johnston has been chronicling the daily lives of a family called the Pattersons in her strip, For Better or For Worse, almost every day for nearly 30 years... in 2,000 newspapers, in 20 countries, and in 8 languages.
So life's not perfect, it's not ideal. I wouldn't trade it for anything better, better, or for worse.
I asked her to sum up the creative process.
Better, better, or for worse.
It's 4 little windows and 4 camera angles. And the way I work is that I time it more or less the way you'd time a stage play. And I draw everything out in pencil first, which for me is like drawing a ghost. It's all sort of soft and loose and transparent. And then when I ink everything, and I use the old-fashioned quill pen and India ink, it's almost like touching the side of the face when you touch it with the pen and drawing the hair. It feels like you're really drawing the hair. It's just a magic that... You just have to see it happen. It just sort of flows from your head to your hand.
And it's not just about the art. You have to be a good writer, too.
My parents were very British, and they would say, if we only have one language, we're going to learn it well. And, of course, we had our thesaurus. We had to learn how to use a word every day and learn to use it in a sentence. And so just having that language, plus poetry. You need poetry. You need an economy of words when you're doing this type of thing, because if you run too long or too short, or if the words don't have that nice cadence to them, you almost ruin the gag because your reader has to read through from the beginning to the end without a stumbling block.
If I'm writing a joke, sometimes I'll put a nice little turn of phrase, and I know as soon as I write that turn of phrase, in half an hour's time, I'll just have to cross it out because it's not relevant to the joke. So you've really got to pare it down to the very basic. You can hardly even use adjectives. It's almost anti-writing.
Russell Taylor of the long-standing duo behind the strip Alex in the Daily Telegraph. Together with artist Charles Petey, they tell the story of an arrogant merchant banker in the city and his lacklustre sidekick Clive. I asked them, why 4 panels?
It's basically because that's the best way to deliver a joke. I mean,
you set up the expectation in the first frame, where they are. Then you have 2 frames of sort of normally quite ambiguous language, which appears to send you one way, and then the last frame says, no, no, you're completely wrong. Actually, they were talking about something completely different.
What have we got under here, then? When you think of where the artists keep their work... And it's under a desk in the corner of the room, under a brown blanket. There's a dozen portfolios. Here we are. There's one here. Wow. I'm going to unfurl these.
That's a good one to read. That one's okay. Please, I like that one. That one's funny anyway.
So let's go frame by frame here. So this is Clive and... Clive says, right, I'm off to my client meeting. And the lady says, don't forget the bank's new travel policy, Clive. As a cost-cutting measure, we're now required to take public transport rather than a taxi wherever possible.
How ridiculous. The bank should be trying to boost morale. It's important to arrive at a meeting in a relaxed, positive, confident frame of mind, and I can't see how that's helped by going on the bus. So I shall take a taxi like other bankers do. And Then he's in the taxi in the last frame of the cab. He's going, add a bloke in the back of the cab from the Continent Bank. He says they're firing 5,000 and stateside's just got rid of 10,000 according to a banker I picked up from there. So you've got Clive. I mean, it's an incredibly fruitful world, the city, because, I mean, sort of all human life is there. I mean, to take a reductive view of it, it's almost like Steve Bell writes about the people who think they control the world and you write about the people that really do control the world.
When it started, it was just like Alex the Yuppie, and we didn't really think it was going to last very long. But the economy's become the story that's kind of constantly on the front pages. So in a way, yeah, we're lucky to find a territory that people started knowing about.
Whereas Russell and Charles know that their strip is an idiosyncratic window on the news, Gary Trudeau will on occasion use Doonesbury as a platform for issues that people don't necessarily take in as they skim the headlines.
There is the advantage of emotional involvement, that the readers come to care about the characters and thus their points of view may resonate a little bit more strongly. People get involved in a way that they might not with a columnist, say.
Five American soldiers have been killed and three are missing following an attack by insurgents.
Three American soldiers have been killed in two separate attacks in Baghdad.
Five American soldiers have been killed in an attack on their patrol in Iraq. Seven others were wounded when a road...
In 2004, Trudeau caused a national furore when he used his space simply to list the American war dead. He'd already drawn attention to returning amputees by having regular character BD lose a limb in a roadside bombing in Iraq. Now, he switched his focus once more. As he leafed through a pile of artwork in front of us, it was incredibly exciting for me to see the original pencil renderings of the very next week's set of strips.
This week that you see here on my desk is about a new character named Toggle. Now, Toggle was a soldier who was created so that I could get into the issue of TBI, traumatic brain injury, which is the signature wound in Iraq right now. There are far more kids who are coming home with TBI in the tens of thousands than the amputees who have a higher profile. And so I created Toggle specifically for that reason. He receives this injury as a result of his own carelessness. He's listening to music on an iPod in his Hummer, and his sergeant tells him to slow down because he spots an IED, and he doesn't because he doesn't hear the command, and he gets blown up. And so he's brought home, and his mother has come to pick him up. And she says,
and as if seeing the strips wasn't enough, Trudeau then starts reading them to me.
As they are driving home, she says, listen, honey, about the house, we ran into some problems with the mortgage. They said, I'm afraid we lost it. Your mama got totally screwed over by a scumbag lender. Anyways, we've moved into a new place, a rental, but don't worry, it's cute. And Toggle thinks, cute? How cute? Who needs bedrooms? You know, his mother replies as we cut to a...
We reveal that they're in a mobile home.
Right. And so this gets into something that actually is in the news, which is the real estate debacle that has overtaken this country.
So, in addition to bedding in a new character, he has to maintain the overall storyline, talk about the subprime mortgage crisis, and on top of that, try to make brain damage funny.
This particular character was a real challenge because of the limitations of speech. He's suffering from something called aphasia, a particular kind of aphasia called Broca's aphasia. And the reason I chose Broca's is that it's characterized by the victim being able to think coherently but not speak coherently. And so you have two tracks. You have what he's thinking and what he's saying. So those two voices and the disparity between them creates wonderful comic potential that's not at his expense, and that's very important.
In just four frames, Trudeau rams home uncomfortable truths that the American mainstream media seem content to shy away from.
I have a sense of mission about getting that story out, particularly since the country has kind of in many ways moved beyond the Iraq story. We're not even allowed to show photographs of the bodies returning. And the president has never been to a memorial service. So we do our best to hide the price of war.
Steve Bell also feels compelled to expose the slippery world of politics through the passion that he feels for cartooning.
I sometimes feel a sort of missionary zeal to try and sort of, you know, cartoons are great. I think cartoons are wonderful, and they are underappreciated, especially in this country.
Some people have described your work as vulgar. If I have to give you an example, I'm thinking of a delightful episode in If where a whale made love to a nuclear submarine. Do you think that's a fair criticism of you?
Oh, yeah, I can't deny that one. Yes, it is vulgar. Some people just don't get that kind of humour. They really resent it and dislike it. there's nothing I can do to bring them round.
There appears to be a great sort of British tradition of that. Yes. Do you feel that you're part of the British tradition of vulgarity?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it is particularly English, I suppose, that tradition. It goes back 200, 300 years. Also, this thing about highly personally abusive to those in power. So if you look what James Gilray was doing about the monarch and about the Prince of Wales, is a sort of later contemporary with Hogarth, and he was doing stuff you wouldn't dare try these days. You know, his virulent, wonderful images, attacking everybody. I mean, he was attacking the king, he was attacking the prince, attacking the French Revolution.
So it is a noble art with a long tradition. But surely the motivation to keep on tirelessly drawing a cartoon strip day in, day out, goes beyond mere political lambasting. Bill Griffith.
What it became for me was like writing entries in a diary every day. I work 6 days a week. It's just like breathing to me.
So it's therapeutic. Anything else?
Zippy keeps me from picking up a gun and running down the street.
So you're suggesting there should be pen control?
Yes, basically. Yes. Doing Zippy, the satirical / political content in Zippy, is something I do literally to keep from exploding. And I'd rather explode into the comic strip than buttonhole people on the street corner.
You're like physically like taking your pen, or in my case, computer, tablet. Just putting some ink on some paper can be very cathartic.
Michaela Reed is one of a group of up-and-coming political artists called Cartoonists with Attitude. Sat in her Brooklyn flat drinking beer, she and her co-members told me what it was that got them drawing.
9/11 is when a lot of us became political cartoonists.
Exactly.
I was in school for mechanical engineering, and I was just goofing around with doodles, and then when I really got angry about the political situation here, that's when I started doing comics.
After 9/11 happened, what I always say is, you know, George Bush rescued me from the dreary life of a non-cartoonist, because it immediately seemed to me that that was like the most vital thing I could be doing. I had to do it. I was so mad.
But here's an interesting thing. I mean, why don't you march? Why aren't you active in a more literal sense?
I can draw cartoons about like economic issues and poverty and racism and, but like, well, I'm busy at my drawing board. I'm sitting here drawing. I don't have time to go march. And sometimes I do feel like it's a little bit of an excuse, but every movement needs its artists. My parents marched in the, I mean, they were always getting tear gassed, and I've never been tear gassed. I'm like kind of embarrassed.
These are extraordinarily turbulent political times that we live in now, particularly in America. We're on the brink of something of a shift in values with the possible arrival of the country's first ever black president. Presumably, you've got to kind of find a different way to go at your political...
Well, the right wing will still be there attacking him, just as they attacked Bill Clinton, Dukakis, everyone before him.
I will say, after 8 years of Bush, it has gotten a little stale talking about the Bush administration, and so I definitely am ready for some fresh meat.
And it's not like every Democrat is pure and golden. Like, they do pretty shitty things too, but still, like, the status quo is never what we want, and everything can be improved upon, and we can always, like, say something to that effect.
I was impressed with these young cartoonists' work, both on the internet and in published anthologies. They're vibrant, witty, intelligent and contentious. But they're working in a declining market and they're under enormous pressure financially. How does their group face the challenge of such an uncertain future?
When you get together, I mean, what sort of shape do the meetings take? Is it like a sort of support group?
Well, it's not even that lofty. It usually devolves into Photoshop technical speak.
Photoshop, complaining about not being enough newspapers.
How the internet doesn't pay.
Yeah. That is a favorite topic.
Well, as discouraged as we get at times, I think all of us would find it very hard to just quit drawing cartoons. Mm. Most of us do this because we have to. Cartooning doesn't pay well financially, but it pays well existentially.
But the future, I mean, where do you see the future? Sorry. We'll start with Brian.
Oh, well, the future is obviously online, because our work is like very based on card events.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It has to go out there immediately. But just figuring out how to turn revenue into it is a very difficult process.
In an ideal world, what would happen?
It's pretty simple. I just want to have people recognize my work and get paid for it and live comfortably.
Cartooning used to be this very, like, good career to be in the United States. It used to pay huge money. And, you know, we're hoping that that day will come again. We're just not sure, like, what form it's going to take. I mean, it's so hard to tell what's going to happen next.
Michaela Reed, Mashika Wood, Jen Sorensen and Brian McFadden, Cartoonists with Attitude. I don't get that same sense of a young politicised movement of cartoonists in the UK, but either I'm not looking hard enough or they're very underground. Creators of Alex, Charles Petey and Russell Taylor.
When we started about 20 years ago, we went to cartoonist events and we were always the young whippersnappers, and we go there and we still are. Which is really worrying.
We're still the Anton Deck.
The Anton Deck of the cartoon world.
I think the editors would love more cartoons. Yeah, I just don't think they're the people doing cartoons out there.
People always say, kind of like, oh, isn't it terribly competitive? And you go, well, no, not really. I mean, I still think a lot of newspaper editors reckon that they could go out into the street and kind of hail one like a taxi. Yeah, cartoonist.
But why the problem in this country?
Part of the reason is that there aren't so many magazines that carry cartoons nowadays, probably partly because they're designed in-house. And so there aren't so many kind of lower rungs of the ladder for people to kind of clamber up from.
Every once in a while, one seems to sort of crop up, but the ones that I've seen in the last decade seem very much style over content.
I don't think people learn to draw as much. You know, although they don't look like it, cartoons depend on a sort of fairly academic way of being able to draw and being able to draw figures from any angle.
Back in New York, Gary Trudeau can use his extraordinary talent to make people think, but he also knows that when readers turn to his four-panel strip, he has a duty to make them laugh.
That is the covenant between reader and writer, that the strip will entertain. And that is uniquely challenging when you're trying to write about war and about very serious subjects. But that's what black humor is for. That's what it's always been used for. It's to really create the sort of thin membrane between reality and madness. You know, it keeps you sane.
And in an increasingly maddening world, sanity is a declining commodity. It was time to come home.
All right, so I've got my books signed, and in the bag they go.
Thank you very much, Gary. Real treat. Thank you, my friend.
So I've just met Gary Trudeau, and I'm just completely speechless. I've seen his original pencil artwork. All of these artists that we've spoken to in the programme all doing a similar thing in completely different ways, from completely different motivations. This is the astonishing thing that I've learned over the course of this programme. Each of them are doing exactly the same thing in an entirely different way, and that is why it's such an important art form to me. I will always wish that I'd never bothered being a stand-up and had been a cartoonist instead, and this is the closest I've come to deciding to jack it all in and buy a drawing board, and maybe I bloody will. Hello, New York.
Fever till you sizzle, but what a lovely way to burn. What a lovely way to burn. What a lovely way to burn. What a lovely way to burn.